From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump's White House Commission on the Opioid Crisis is asking him to declare a national emergency, saying every day 142 Americans die from a drug overdose, creating a September 11 death toll every 3 weeks. The panel was chaired by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. It included Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker, Governor Roy Cooper of North Carolina, and former Congressman Patrick Kennedy of Rhode Island. Let's get some response from someone on the front lines. Dr. Andrew Kolodny is co-director of opioid policy research at Brandeis University's Heller School for Social Policy and Management. Dr. Kolodny, we know it feels like a national emergency to you and everyone on the front lines, but your thoughts on the panel's call to declare it one?
Well, it is an emergency, and it doesn't just feel like it. We are in the midst of the worst drug addiction epidemic in United States history. 300,000 Americans have lost their lives to opioid overdoses since 1999, and communities and towns across the country have been devastated by the problem. So this isn't an exaggeration to call it a public health emergency. It certainly is.
Well, and calling it that, the commission says, is the key to unlocking federal funds and action to address the crisis, to do things like provide money for federal agencies to develop sensors to detect the synthetic opioid fentanyl, which we know has been brought into the country from other countries and has led to an increase in these overdose deaths. So money to kind of combat that, money to pay for every law enforcement officer to have the overdose reversal drug naloxone. They're also calling for policy like requiring doctors, physician assistants, nurses in federally qualified health centers to get waivers to prescribe a medication for opioid addiction. So a waiver in policy there. Your thoughts on what is being recommended and what's missing?
Well, I do think the recommendation that healthcare professionals working in federally qualified health centers should become eligible to prescribe buprenorphine. I think that's a very smart recommendation. Unlike oxycodone, which is in OxyContin, or hydrocodone, which is in Vicodin, any healthcare professional with a DEA registration can prescribe those medications without any training requirement, without any limit on the number of patients they can treat. Even though those drugs are highly addictive and responsible for thousands of overdoses, buprenorphine, on the other hand, is a much safer opioid. For example, it's much harder to overdose on buprenorphine, yet we have restrictions on its use. We require doctors and other health professionals to take an 8-hour training course before we will let them prescribe the medication. And what this recommendation will do, if it's followed up on, is it will lead to a requirement that every eligible prescriber would be mandated to take the training necessary to prescribe buprenorphine. One of the things that has to happen if we're going to see overdose deaths come down is there needs to be very easy access to buprenorphine. Patients who are opioid addicted have to be able to access buprenorphine more easily than they can access prescription opioids or heroin or fentanyl.
Well, what about prescribers, people who doctors, nurses give out the prescriptions for opioids? It's well known that, part of the crisis is that these drugs were overprescribed. The commission is calling for everyone who has registered with the DEA, which is anyone who has to prescribe these drugs, get training in prescribing opioids. That sounds like a great idea. You say what?
Mandatory education for prescribers sounds like a great idea, but there's a right way to do this and a wrong way to do it. If you mandate that all prescribers have to take training in using opioid medication, that could actually result in some prescribers who don't currently prescribe any opioids starting to prescribe opioids. It could potentially lead to more opioid prescribing, which is the last thing we need. A smarter way to do this would be mandatory prescriber education for healthcare professionals who intend to prescribe more than a 3-day supply, and let everybody else opt out. If you let people opt out from the training, but then they're limited to 3 days or less, that would be very helpful. We'd be shrinking the pool of clinicians who are allowed to prescribe aggressively. A three-day supply would become the default instead of 7 days or 14 days. It would lead to much more cautious prescribing.
Dr. Andrew Kolodny, co-director of opioid policy research at Brandeis University's Heller School for Social Policy and Management, reacting to today's report from the White House panel asking President Trump to declare a national emergency on opioids. Dr. Kolodny, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we've reported a lot on the H-2B visa, which is for temporary non-agricultural workers who come to the U.S. from other countries. The H-2A visa program brings in farm workers who fill jobs that Americans often don't want. That program is growing, up 181% in the last 10 years. But there are concerns that some of the visa holders are not being treated properly on the job and aren't reporting those labor abuses. Matthew Casey of Here and Now contributor KJZZ reports on what's being done about that.
Summer is watermelon season in the Harquahala Valley, about an hour west of Phoenix. After a day of harvesting, white buses bring migrant workers to the Rio Valley Market. The only store for miles sells anything from spices to underwear. The workers are here on a temporary visa called a H-2A. They still wear sweat-stained clothes from the field, but their mood is light as they buy popsicles, soda, chips, and beer. Marco Raul Medrano is from Guatemala, where he grew corn and beans. He says farm work here is easier because you make more money. While Medrano is here, this store might be his only contact with the outside world. That's because the company he works for gives him food, shelter, and transportation. Experts say this can make H-2A workers vulnerable to abuse. The U.S. Department of Labor has touted a civil lawsuit it filed in May against G Farms in Arizona as part of new efforts to punish bad actors.
We would have been looking at a mass fatality. This housing situation was not even close to safe.
Janet Harold is the Western Regional Solicitor for the U.S. Department of Labor, which enforces H-2A rules. She accused G Farms of not paying workers the full wage and making them live in unsafe and unsanitary conditions inside converted school buses. Harold says her team took immediate action to help guest workers at G Farms and punish their employer.
It's a lot of work, and it requires a lot of resources.
Using the G Farms case as an example, Secretary of Labor Alexander Acosta called on the entire agency to work with its Office of Inspector General, or OIG, to seek criminal charges against abusive employers. Harold would not say if the investigation into G Farms is now a criminal case.
OIG is aware of the case. That's all I can really say.
Mike King is an attorney for G Farms. He says the Labor Department had no reason to bring the civil case.
By the time they filed the lawsuit, the things alleged in the lawsuit had been corrected.
Arizona regulators cited G Farms for overcrowded sleeping areas, electrical cords near showers, and a water supply that had not been approved.
Doesn't mean anything was wrong with it. It was not inspected first. That's what that means.
G Farms settled the safety violations with the state, but it did not admit liability. The owners did agree to pay a roughly $1,700 fine, an amount King says does not match the accusation of inhumane living conditions.
I would prefer not to say that the government is making an example of my clients, but you do see it in any range of regulatory matters. There's not enough resources to prosecute everyone.
The number of H-2A workers has skyrocketed from about 59,000 in 2006 to roughly 166,000 last year, which means the Labor Department has a lot more farmers to keep an eye on than it used to. Federal data show a 20% growth in the number of H-2A visas approved during the current fiscal year. But there's no plan to hire more enforcement agents, leaving migrant workers vulnerable.
Farm workers in general are the most abused population of laborers in our country.
Pamela Bridge is the director of advocacy and litigation at Community Legal Services. She spent two decades fighting for migrant farm worker rights.
We've seen workers who are not given water, told to get their water from an irrigation ditch. That's where they should bathe. That's where they should drink.
Bridge says the claims against G Farms are especially shocking.
If the allegations are true, absolutely those conditions are inhumane. No one should have to live like that.
Back at the Rio Valley Market, 38-year-old Marco Raul Medrano looks forward to an evening of television and rest. It's his fourth trip to the U.S., and he hopes there will be more. God willing, he says. Medrano gives short answers to my questions. It might be because he doesn't want to miss the bus or because there are bosses around. I ask if the farm treats him well. Yes, he says, it's good. Medrano has two kids in school in Guatemala. His goal is to help them get ahead, and his H-2A visa gives him until November to earn enough money to make it happen. For Here and Now, I'm Matthew Casey.
The Netflix documentary The Keepers is up for an Emmy for Best Documentary or Nonfiction Series. It tells the story of the murder of Sister Kathy Sesnik, a Baltimore nun and Catholic school teacher who disappeared on November 7, 1969. Her body was found almost 2 months later. The case remains unsolved. In the documentary, we meet two women, former students of Sister Kathy, who are spending their days and nights trying to find out what happened nearly 50 years later. We also meet a woman who may hold the key to why Sister Kathy was killed. She says she was sexually abused by priests at the school and that Kathy Sesnik was going to tell somebody about it. Ryan White is the director and producer of The Keepers, and he joins us now from L.A. Ryan, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
And how did you first hear about this story of Sister Kathy Sesnik?
So my family is actually from Baltimore, from a big Catholic family there. And my aunt actually went to the high school, which is the epicenter of the whole story of The Keepers, which is a high school called Archbishop Keough. And she was Sister Kathy's student. And she was also classmates with some of the women who are women in their 60s now who are abuse victims at this school and are some of the main characters in The Keepers.
And was this a story that you heard about when you were growing up?
No. I know it's a story that haunted my aunt her entire life because her favorite teacher was murdered, but it's something that never made its way to me. So a few years ago, there's a mystery character in The Keepers named Jane Doe, who was this woman who had claimed that she had been abused at this high school and then she had been taken to see the body of Sister Kathy by the head priest of the school, Father Maskell. And the woman was always known as Jane Doe under that pseudonym. And a few years ago, my mom and my aunt found out that Jane Doe was in fact their friend, Jean Wayner, who's putting her face and name on Jane Doe in The Keepers, and they connected me with her, and that was my whole entry point to this, you know, deep and dark story.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of Jean Wayner or Jane Doe from the documentary. She believes that the abuse that she suffered and others suffered at the high school played a role in Sister Kathy Sesnik's murder.
Kathy Sesnik was killed because she was going to talk about what went on at that school. And I believe that there were more than one person who was really afraid that she was going to out them. And they used her death to keep me quiet.
Now, when she says keep me quiet, she did stay quiet about what she knew for many years afterward, and part of that has to do with her repressing these memories without even noticing that she was doing so.
Yeah, Jean is a story of repressed memory and actually was the first person to come forward with allegations against Father Maskell in the 90s when she was in her early 40s when these memories began coming back to her. And as we know now, she's been corroborated by dozens, if not hundreds of people. But in the 90s, when she came forward, she was really doubted by not only the church, but the state as well, the authority figures, and sort of made to seem crazy and unbelievable and unfortunately was forced back into silence in the 90s until we started making this documentary.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think she faced so much pushback about her story?
Well, I think the Catholic Church is very powerful in Baltimore. And as we examine in the documentary, unfortunately, they exert a lot of power over the state institutions as well. And so Father Maskell himself was a very well-connected man, and he was chaplain for the Baltimore police. He was Johns Hopkins-trained psychologist. And unfortunately, he was bringing a lot of these colleagues and people that he knew into the abuse ring as well. So there were a lot of people who were threatened. If these abuse victims ever spoke up, there were a lot of people threatened if Sister Kathy ever did something about it. And there were a lot of people that when it started to come out in the 90s, didn't want it to come out.
Two people that we hear from a lot in your documentary are Gemma Hoskins and Abby Schaub, who are former students of Sister Kathy's, who are investigating her murder kind of on an amateur basis, although they look like professionals in terms of what they're doing. Let's listen to a little bit of them.
Gemma's been the Nancy Drew, I think. She's good at getting people to talk to her, to calling them up and talk to her.
Abby does amazing research, like no one I've ever met. I like to get on the phone and talk to people and draw the pictures.
And I hate to talk to people, so that works.
What's going on? Our mission, we were driven to find out who hurt Sister Kathy. We have people telling us to be careful.
Our concern was that she fell into something evil, something bad, and got caught up with it. We're told that the story is not the nun's killing. The story is the cover-up of the nun story.
Tell us about what they have been doing and how important they were in your telling of this story.
Well, as a storyteller, they were gold to me because it was such an interesting way to look at a true crime documentary through the eyes of, as you heard in that clip, they call themselves Nancy Drew grandmas. And what they've done in Baltimore, I mean, these are two incredibly brave women who were not going to allow the truth to be silenced anymore. And they were sticking up for their fellow sisters from Archbishop Keough High School and for their favorite teacher, Sister Kathy. So I began the documentary, I think it's a little over 3 years ago now. And the amount of progress that Gemma and Abby have made in forcing this story to be brought to light is just mind-blowing. And they deserve so much credit for the fact that we're even talking about Sister Kathy still, or what happened at Archbishop Keough now.
Why do you think they're doing what they're doing?
Well, I think that this was their favorite teacher. And as they'll both say, it always haunted them their entire lives that there were no answers. And they also had positive experiences at this high school. And so when they found out that their friends were part of this torture that was happening within the walls of the same high school where they had a positive experience, they didn't think it was right that the story had been deliberately buried. It all began through Facebook. When they started this Facebook group, they realized right away that they were creating a safe haven for women and men of this age who were abuse victims of this of Father Maskell and his cohorts. They were creating a safe haven for these people to come out and say, this also happened to me.
Now, Father Maskell certainly comes across in your documentary as a suspect in the murder of Kathy Cesnik, but Baltimore police say his DNA doesn't match the crime scene evidence. What do you think, after having looked into this so much, what do you think his role was?
Well, that DNA sample doesn't mean much. So what they determined was that, and they exhumed his body this year, which obviously is must be very expensive and takes a lot of bureaucracy and red tape and resources, I'm sure. So I actually think that's quite a positive step that they were willing to exhume his body and test him for DNA. Now it begs the question why they never did that in the 90s or the early 2000s when he was still alive and all these allegations were being made about him and he could have been criminally prosecuted. He never was. But no one's prevailing theory has ever been that Father Maskell probably committed the murder himself or that his DNA would be on a cigarette butt that was found near Sister Kathy's body. The prevailing theory has always been that Father Maskell orchestrated this murder, that he would not have done it himself. So I do think it's a positive step that the Baltimore police are finally publicly showing that they're taking him serious as a suspect and that they believe these abuse victims. But it wasn't a surprise that it's not his DNA there.
Was there anybody who wouldn't talk to you?
Oh, there were countless people who wouldn't talk to me. It was a three-year process, and you could feel that we were rooting around in something that people didn't want us rooting around in. So much of the 3 years was spent trying to persuade people to participate or to say, look, I think you need to answer for what you did or didn't do, and you're going to look a lot worse if you just say no comment. So there's various instances throughout the series where you see people stonewalled us, most notably the Archdiocese of Baltimore that refused to go on camera and would only respond in written answers to written questions. But yeah, the entire process of making The Keepers was feeling the tension of people not wanting this story told.
What's been the reaction? I mean, have you been hearing from other survivors of sexual abuse or people who know something about what happened?
Yeah, the reaction, it's been a nauseating couple months since The Keepers came out. I'm obviously very proud of this series, and I'm very proud that it's been so successful and so many people have watched it, but I had not prepared myself for the type of reaction, the ripple effects that were going to come. It almost feels as if we ripped a bandage off of a wound worldwide. From the day The Keepers came out, all of my inbox, social media, my emails were filling up with abuse stories from people that I don't know, people telling me the most horrible, painful parts of their lives and asking me if I could come document that. And so I'm very proud of the success as a filmmaker, of course, but it's also been deeply upsetting to see how prevalent this is and how it's still happening and knowing, you know, I can't go to all of these places around the world and document these people's stories who are moved by watching people like Gene.
Well, what do you want to do next? I mean, are you going to do anything else with this story, or are you moving on to other things?
No, I'm moving on to other things. I'm very happy with the 7 episodes of The Keepers and where the story ends. Of course, I'm following it closely still, and so much information is coming out of the woodwork, both about the murder and the abuse and cover-ups still. So I'm not planning on doing any follow-up or a season 2. Perhaps we will do some follow-up at some point. So I'm keeping my eye on it, but I'm planning on moving on to other projects, and I'm just really thrilled with the community response to The Keepers, of what's happening in Baltimore and all of the progress and movement that's coming out of the series having been released.
Well, it is a terrific documentary. Ryan White, director and producer of the Netflix series The Keepers, which is up for an Emmy for Best Documentary or Nonfiction Series. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
A popular vacation destination in North Carolina remains without power after a construction accident forced tens of thousands of people to evacuate over the weekend. Construction crews working on a bridge in the state's Outer Banks accidentally damaged 3 underground power cables Thursday morning, cutting power to the islands of Hatteras and Ocracoke during the height of the tourist season. For more, we're joined now by Bobby Outen, who's manager of Dare County, which includes Hatteras Island. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
And on Saturday, Dare County issued a mandatory evacuation order citing life safety issues and growing uncertainty as to when repairs to that main transmission line are going to be completed. Do you have an update about when people are going to be able to return?
We do not. The power company has been working night and day, 24 hours. You know, they've dug and excavated the cut lines. They're bringing them up, and they're also doing some overhead patches, and whichever one gets fixed first is the one that they'll use to get the power back on. Their estimates yesterday were 6 to 10 days, and hopefully they'll improve, but so far we don't know anything different than that.
But here we are right in the height of the tourist season. How big of a hit is this to the local economy?
Well, it's certainly significant for the folks on Hatteras Island, and it's significant to the county as well. Hatteras Island represents, I don't know, 28% to a third of the economy on Dare County, and our economy is about, you know, $1 billion a season. So you can do the math. I don't know what that comes out to, but a week down is a pretty significant hit, and it's a really significant hit to the small businesses and to the people that work in those small businesses down on Hatteras Island.
Well, you say a week down, but do you think that people are going to be canceling their vacations even after that because of the uncertainty about it?
We hope not, because once the power is back up, the power will be back up. I don't think there's uncertainty going forward once the power company gives us the okay that we can begin allowing our visitors back on the island, and we're confident that we have power and things are back to normal.
Do you think that something could have been done to prevent this? I mean, it was an accident, but still.
It's hard to know because, to be honest with you, I'm not sure I really know how it occurred. I know that they drove a piling through 3 cables, or two out of 3 cables, but I don't really know how that occurred, how it was marked, any of those details. So far, we haven't focused on that. We've been focusing on getting things going, trying to take care of the needs of our people down on Hatteras Island, and doing the other things to improve the situation.
So what would your message be right now to business owners, homeowners in Hatteras Island, or vacationers?
For the vacationers, I would say sit tight, don't make any plans. We're hoping to get this thing resolved quickly, and it can't be a better place for them to come. I'm looking out the window right now. The weather is beautiful. There's crystal blue skies, not real hot. So we're hoping we can get this thing up and running and get them down here. With respect to our businesses, the same thing. We're working as hard as we can, doing everything we can do at the county level, doing everything we can do to encourage the state and the electric company to move. And certainly they're doing everything they can do. They all get it. You know, we'll get them up and running as quick as we can.
That's Bobby Outen, who is the Dare County manager in North Carolina. And by the way, you're in a part of Dare County that has power right now, correct?
Right. We're north of Oregon Inlet, and we have power, and the power is out south of Oregon Inlet.
All right. Well, good luck to you in dealing with this. Bobby Outen, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay. Thank you.
A Finnish icebreaker just set a record for the earliest and fastest trip through the Arctic's Northwest Passage. The MSV Nordica took 24 days to travel the more than 6,200-mile route connecting the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. The previous record was 25 days in 2008, a Canadian ship. And of course, 100 years ago, it was impossible. But much of the ice that once made the passage impassable has melted. Journalists from the AP traveled with the crew to study climate change. AP reporter Frank Jordan joins us by Skype from Greenland, where they landed on Saturday. Frank, what was the passage like?
It was an amazing journey. Very few people have enjoyed this kind of trip, this kind of experience. The Northwest Passage has only been open for about 100 years. And during the course of that time, less than 500 ships passed through the passage. And we were one of them, and we did it in record time and early.
Yeah, well, and you are along to study the effects of climate change. Yeah, thrilling to set this record, but it also means that the thing that you're studying is worse than ever.
Yes, of course, it's always difficult to say what exactly climate change did this year that made it so much easier. There are several factors at play that we had very favorable weather conditions this year. We were very well prepared. We had a fantastic crew and great icebreaker. But of course, we also encountered very little sea ice.
So you got to see how it's diminishing. Scientists predict the Northwest Passage might be ice-free by 2050, and this, of course, in the summer, if the levels of warming continue. But what else did you see? I mean, what a glorious time to be just away from it all. What kind of sea life did you see?
Yes, it's a very different world up there than anything I have experienced before. And I think most people would be the same. First of all, it's sunny almost all day. So there's a lot of light. You have this very sort of alien landscape, no trees. When you're in the ice, all this white around you, and the wildlife. I mean, at first, we were just accompanied by a few birds, but then after a few days in the Northwest Passage, we saw our first polar bear. And that obviously is an amazing experience to see these fantastic creatures in the wild. We also saw narwhals, which are whales known for their tusk, and they have one tusk protruding out the front. They're known as the unicorns of the sea. And of course, dozens and dozens of seal species and Arctic birds, yes.
The polar bear, polar bears depend on the sea ice to go out and hunt for fish. Sort of some of the native peoples there, the Inuit population, they are endangered because of the shrinking ice. I mean, of course, you were on an icebreaker. Did you have to break the ice? Did you have to use the ship's capability to do that?
Well, that's a very good question. Actually, the captain and the ice navigator told us, somewhat to our surprise, that the main objective is not to break ice.
I was wondering about that. Yeah, because it's breaking and disappearing anyway.
Indeed. Where possible, the icebreaker tries to simply drive through floes that it then pushes aside, or around large ones that it doesn't really need to break if it can circumvent them. When it's not possible otherwise, the icebreaker can break ice in several different ways. And obviously, one that's built for this purpose alone is very good at doing so.
You had a reminder of just how much things have changed. There was that famous expedition, 1845, British explorer John Franklin trying to find the Northwest Passage. Then, of course, it was entirely ice-locked. They never made it, trapped by the sea ice. The whole crew died from, you know, starvation and the cold. Their ships were found in 2014 and 2016. We understand, according to AP reporting, around where you guys saw the first polar bear there. Well, that must have been chilling to think of what had happened to another crew going through at another time.
Yes, the Northwest Passage has resulted in a grim fate for many an explorer over the centuries. And the most famous one is obviously this Franklin exhibition, two huge British Navy ships stacked with years' worth of provisions and experienced sailors on board. And the ice conditions were different back then. They did get caught in sea ice. Once they got caught, there was no way for them to break out. These were sailing ships. And so they had to try and wait through one winter and hope that they would be able to break out the next summer. And they didn't manage that. And so after 3 years, all of the crew had perished.
A cautionary tale. That's AP reporter Frank Jordans. He was on the Finnish icebreaker that just made the earliest known transit through the Northwest Passage. We'll link you to his stories, photographs from his colleagues, also on board at hereandnow.org. Frank, lucky trip. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
This just in, single women are buying homes at nearly twice the rate of single men. This is according to the National Association of Realtors. And Rutland, Vermont now boasts a how-to course taught by and designed for women on the basics of home repair. And women are signing up like crazy. Nina Keck from Here and Now contributor Vermont Public Radio reports.
Laura Budd admits she's of a certain age, having grown up with a clear division of labor between the sexes. Case in point, using tools, basic plumbing, and electrical work. She says those were not skills her parents taught her.
Even when I moved out to my own apartment, if I needed something, I would call my dad and he would come fix it. You know, I just never learned how to do any of these things.
That's why she signed up for a 5-week basic home repair class offered by NeighborWorks of Western Vermont, a local nonprofit that promotes homeownership. Bud says the course is less intimidating since it's just for women, and having a female teacher makes it easier to ask questions.
We're going to try and do a real quick survey of some tools right now. We're going to play a little game, and then we're going to go to Pine Street, and we're going to get our hands dirty.
Morgan Overable is the instructor. She's worked as a carpenter for nearly 20 years and now supervises home building sites in Rutland for NeighborWorks.
I was so blessed to have a very patient grandfather and a very skilled contractor father.
Overable says the idea for the class came to her after she noticed single women were buying houses she renovated. She approached NeighborWorks about teaching a course specially designed for women that would cover basic plumbing and electrical work, simple carpentry, and hand tools.
I think that culturally, men are just handed down this knowledge, and it's assumed that women don't want it. And so I have proven that that is not the case, because this class filled up in 48 hours. But even now, we're sitting on a wait list of 25 or more.
So, blue team, I want you to reach into your tool bag and pull out the adjustable wrench.
The class runs for 2 hours on Tuesday evenings. Besides instruction, each student gets a home repair handbook and a toolkit that Overable thinks every woman should have and be able to use.
All right. This is known as an adjustable wrench, or a lot of people call it a crescent wrench. But the crescent wrench is a brand name, okay? In construction, you'll find that happens a lot.
Tuition costs $25, thanks to a grant from the National NeighborWorks of America project. To provide hands-on time for students, Overable uses some of the vacant houses she's renovating as classrooms. Tonight, students take turns under bathroom sinks, learning how to deal with clogs.
Oh, I see, because this is flat right here. And this part right here isn't flat. Man, this is more complicated than the back.
There you go.
Katie Brady smiles after successfully using her new channel lock pliers. She says neither she nor her husband are especially handy, so she hopes the course will make her feel more confident about dealing with household problems that come up.
So even if I'm not at the point where I can fix it, if I can say, okay, I remember this, I think this is what's going on, then you don't feel so lost.
For Here and Now, I'm Nina Keck in Rutland, Vermont.
You've got one of those. Great. You're going to be able to fix this after tonight.
Have to take that course. And you're listening to Here and Now.
Apple will report its third quarter earnings later today. Analysts are expecting sales to be down, at least by Apple standards, which is to say $45 billion on around 40 million iPhone shipments. But more people are interested to hear what Apple has to say about its next quarter and this year's new iPhone launch. Meanwhile, the digital currency Bitcoin is officially splitting in two today. Now, in addition to Bitcoin, there will be an alternative called Bitcoin Cash, and the changes could affect the price of both. Here to explain is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ed Lee is managing editor of Recode and joins us now. Hi, Ed.
Hey.
Well, let's start with Apple. What are we expecting to hear today from them?
So as you pointed out, you know, their sales for the quarter previous will be about sort of $4 to $5 billion or shade under is what we're looking for. The bigger thing to look for is what they give guidance for in the current quarter, the 3 months ending September. The reason is that, you know, if they give a higher guidance, that tells us, oh, they're likely to ship the new phone in September. If they give a lower guidance, then they're more likely to have moved it off to at least October. You know, it's only a difference of maybe 2 weeks, but it changes their reporting, certainly.
What do we know about the new phone?
So there's a lot has already leaked out. There's likely not going to be a home button anymore. It's going to be a bigger screen relative to the size of the physical phone. And there could be facial recognition as a way to open or unlock the phone as opposed to punching in a series of numbers or using your thumbprint. And just faster processor, better camera, that sort of thing.
Are they bringing the headphone jack back?
I don't think that's going to happen.
That's done as forever? Much as people, I mean,
that's done forever. Yeah, exactly.
So
they're trying to actually limit the number of sort of openings or input, so to speak, in the physical device. I think that's part of the reason why.
And they're being hit by a lot of leaks here, right? I mean, Apple is – they're blaming media speculation here.
And they've done that in the past, exactly. You know, there's – first of all, the leaks that happened recently actually came from Apple documents themselves. So that it's actually, in this case, it's their fault. Sometime last year, Tim Cook, CEO, sort of blamed media leaks on sort of lower sales for its current iPhone. The reason why the leaks were suggesting that there was going to be a new phone coming out soon – the truth of it is big hardcore Apple fans know the schedule. So it's not – even then it wasn't that much of a leak.
All right. Let's talk about Bitcoin. This is the digital currency that has been booming in the last few months. One coin worth more than $2,500. But today, Bitcoin is splitting. What does that mean exactly?
It's weird upon weird, right? It's it's unusual for a currency to split. That's never happened, really. What's happening or what has happened, you know, is that there – if you own Bitcoin – chances are you will see a second account with half as much, you know, splitting the amount of Bitcoin you own into a separate account. The separate account of the second kind of coin they're calling Bitcoin Cash, which will be denominated differently. And the reason they're doing that is they just want to make transactions faster. Right now, they're doing about 7 transactions or verifying 7 transactions a second. That's not fast enough compared to things like your credit card and how quickly those things are processed. So the secondary sort of currency here supposedly should be processed faster because they're denominated in bigger blocks.
How could the split affect the price of Bitcoin?
So we don't really know. But in theory, when you create more or when you reduce friction, right, in the process, you know, it's easier to transact. So in theory, it should go up make it more able for people to sort of buy and sell Bitcoin. Again, that's the theory anyway.
Well, and it has really been a roller coaster ride all along for Bitcoin. So we'll keep watching what happens with the price. One more thing I want to ask you about, Ed, and that is Facebook got a lot of attention yesterday after it was revealed that the company's artificial intelligence wing shut down chatbots that had created their own language that humans could not understand. Has humanity reached its end?
It feels like it's becoming self-aware, right? So some context on this, the Facebook researchers actually devised or designed these AI bots to do this, to kind of create a shorthand or a – they didn't call it a new language so much as find a way to communicate to transact a theoretical virtual item. You know, just want to see if they can sort of create a transaction on their own using kind of their own shorthand communication. And it was more or less successful. It didn't work in every instance. And then they shut it down, not because they thought it was getting out of hand necessarily, but just because, okay, so some of it worked and some of it didn't. Maybe this is an interesting experiment, but we don't know what the practical applications are just yet. Google, by the way, did something very similar a few months earlier where they had sort of AI bots create their own language as well.
Didn't they see Westworld? I mean, don't they know the dangers
don't
of this?
They know? But haven't you seen movies? Haven't you seen The Terminator? I mean, don't you know, well, pop culture history?
Well, Elon That's Musk is point. Saying that Mark Zuckerberg basically has limited understanding of AI.
So that is the more recent context around, these incidents, absolutely. So, yeah, I think Elon Musk presents fair warning and fair concern about these things. And he would be in a position to know. He's a very, very smart guy. And right. He's been looking at this very closely. So, yes, there are certain absolutely dangers to having these things kind of run amok. At the same time, it's happening, right? So I think it's a matter of – and this is what Musk is really getting at, right, which is, yes, it's going to happen. We should work on it, but we should manage and limit and keep a close eye on this process to make sure it doesn't get out of hand.
That's Ed Lee, managing editor of Recode. Ed, thanks.
Anytime.